This is Matthew Putman, and you're listening to Utility Function. For the past year, a significant amount of news coverage has focused on the growing technological competition between the U.S. and China. These concerns are progressing at a rapid pace, but it can be difficult to locate the root cause of such complex geopolitical issues. As individuals, we are governed by the effects of technology on both policy and society writ large, and we need to figure out how to best prepare for an uncertain future. In searching for answers to these questions, I invited Chris Miller to join me in a conversation. Chris is the Associate Professor of International History at Tufts, and he's the author of The Very Popular Chip War. His research focuses on seismic shifts in technology, policy, and economics, including the history of U.S. foreign relations. His most recent book details the evolution of microchip design, its geopolitical significance, and the dangers of relying on global supply chains for necessary resources. Chris and I talk about the parallels and differences between the U.S.-China conflict and the Cold War, and the challenges that must be overcome within science and industry as technological achievement continues to move away from a primary focus on material functions to serve civilian interests. We discuss the relationship between distribution of fabs and distribution of power, how to properly allocate CHIPS Act subsidies, and the importance of innovation in the process of revolutionizing chip architecture. In reflecting on his legacy, we also recognize Gordon Moore's profound impact on the advancement of computing power and the status of his influential law as it applies to manufacturing today. Any direction you want also, you've probably given so many interviews in the last few months. I'm sure you're sick of it. It's like, I'm happy to talk about some things that you haven't been talking about if you'd like to.
All right, that sounds good.
I think that I've given away your book more than any book that I have in the last years.
Oh,
no matter where I am, I've been in the Middle East a lot lately. I've been all over, and you know, when anybody wants to know anything about the semiconductor industry, I give this to them.
Glad to hear that.
So congratulations. It's been such enormous success.
Thank you.
I think it's really shaped the way that we all view this stuff. You know, I work in the semiconductor industry a bit, and I still, you know, had so much to learn about the past and, you know, sort of provocative nature of what the future will be. I'd love to hear about how you went from being an expert in Russian history and policy to moving on to semiconductors. You mind talking about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, I started actually planning not to write a book on semiconductors, but rather on the evolution of military power. And I wanted to understand why was it during the Cold War that both the U.S. and the Soviet Union were capable of producing the key defense technologies of the early Cold War, nuclear weapons, long-range missile systems. But by the end of the Cold War, there was a vast gap that had opened up between U.S. and Soviet capabilities, which seemed puzzling because both sides thought that the arms race was really important. They spent billions of dollars on it. And both sides had very smart scientists and engineers. So it wasn't sort of a deficit of brain power that explained the differential. And as I studied the evolution of defense technology, I came to realize that actually, you know, it wasn't just about a certain type of missile or plane or any sort of individual defense system. It was about the application of computing power across militaries. And that led me to realize that actually it wasn't only militaries that had been transformed by computing. All modern life had as well. And it was semiconductors that made it possible to deploy computing capabilities in all manner of devices.
Did it immediately occur to you, or did it occur, or do you even agree with this at all, that we are in the Cold War with China now?
Well, I think, you know, there's some ways that analogy works, some ways that it doesn't work, but there's no doubt that the competition in military, economic, technological terms with China is at a point of both kind of intensifying focus from the U.S. and Chinese side, and also posing dangers, just like the Cold War arms race did. And I think it's, you know, not a coincidence that just like during the Cold War, the race between the two powers then wasn't only about weapon systems or diplomatic prestige. It was also about technology. And one of the key technologies then, as now, was and is computing power.
Do you see an equivalent to the space race with the chips race with China?
Well, I think there certainly are similarities in the sense that there are really complex engineering challenges that have to be overcome, that were in new areas of science and engineering. But I think there are differences too. In the space race during the 1960s, there was really no commercial aspect to it at all. It was just government versus government, military. Whereas in the chip industry, it's still the case that almost all chips that are produced, 97 or 8%, depending on which estimate you look at, go to civilian purposes. And the most advanced chips today are produced by companies, not by militaries. And so that's a key difference, because it means you can't understand the trajectory of technology by looking at what governments want or what they're doing. You've got to understand the market dynamics too.
Yeah, I wonder if there are certain initiatives. You know, we're seeing both the CHIPS Act, which I'm going to ask you about, if you want to talk about that a little bit, but also the way Chinese investment has worked in the industry lately. And there's always this back and forth between whether software is leading or hardware is leading, and how much hardware you need for how much software. And I look at what has happened, and even since your book has come out, in generative AI, for instance, and the hardware that will be required for that, how much does that seem to you like something that is relevant in this question of geopolitics with China?
You know, I think if the question is what matters more, hardware or software, the answer is obviously both. but I'm struck by the extent to which in the layman's understanding of what makes generative AI possible, for example, or what makes any sort of advanced computing possible, we think a lot about software, about computer programmers, about software engineers. And I think we insufficiently place emphasis on the fact that software engineers today are very smart and capable, but they're able to do impressive things largely because they have access to orders of magnitude more transistors than people did decades ago. And so, you know, I ask myself, over the last decade, is it the case that our most capable programmers are 32 times smarter? Or is it the case that thanks to a decade's worth of Moore's Law, they have 32 times as many transistors to work with as people did over 10 years ago?
That feels right. it feels like we haven't gotten that much smarter as a human race in the last. In fact, if you look at Gordon Moore himself, who passed away this weekend, I guess you saw that. I mean, you had some pretty incredible minds in the space for many years, and I think though, when I'm thinking about AI chips, you know, it's heavily NVIDIA chips, I guess, right now, which means it's heavily TSMC. Is this the current trajectory, and how worrisome is that due to political concerns between China and Taiwan?
Well, it is, it's interesting. On the one hand, the fact that there's extraordinary concentration in the chip industry is a good thing, because it creates the efficiencies that we need to make producing chips economically viable. And we wouldn't have gotten, I don't think, the advances that Moore's Law has enabled had it not been for extraordinary efficiency that the industry has produced. And that efficiency has been made possible in part by economies of scale. So you need vast chip making facilities. You need vast companies, I think, to get the scale economies that have driven down cost over time. But as you say, the fact that concentration produces single points of failure is worrisome. And the fact that many of these single points of failure are located either in seismically active zones or in geopolitical hotspots like the Taiwan Straits makes us quite nervous. And I think if you look at Taiwan and TSMC, the leading Taiwanese chip maker, you'll find not only that they produce 90% of the most advanced processor chips, but over a third of the computing power the world has each year comes from chips made in Taiwan. And then that number is really extraordinary, especially given that we're increasingly less capable of providing for Taiwan security.
You know, so much of the attention of a TSMC or other, whatever large semiconductor companies there are, nobody, I guess, competing on the same Moore's Law trajectory in the same way, but are focused on a Moore's Law type scaling. You know, while that is certainly necessary for a lot of applications, there are all these other applications in the semiconductor industry, including for military uses, for chips for military uses,
that don't necessarily require the smallest feature node or transistor density. Is there a world where you see power being more distributed as fabs become more distributed and for specialized applications?
You know, I think in some ways the answer is yes, in that we certainly see via what's called advanced packaging, which often refers to putting different types of chips together in new and innovative ways to get new capabilities. We see that the focus isn't solely on shrinking down the size of transistors, which is hard and expensive. But in other ways, you know, most of the key advances in computing over the past decade and really over the past several decades have been driven by the ability to shrink transistors. And shrinking transistors, cramming more of them onto chips, as Gordon Moore put it in his famous 1965 article, has really been core to all the advances that have enabled the exponential growth in computing power. And that's hard to do unless you've got access to economies of scale that massive facilities provide. And so I think we're still in an industry where the benefits to scale are huge, and therefore the likelihood of concentration is also quite large.
Where do we stand with Moore's Law, do you think? I mean, are we coming to an end?
Well, I think if you look at the way Gordon Moore defined the law, there's actually two parts. He first defined it as the number of components per chip, doubling every year or two. And that is still happening. We've still got a once every 2 years rate of doubling of transistors per chip. The other definition that he used was the average cost per transistor falling. And that's no longer happening for many types of chips. And that's a big problem, because the free lunch of computing power that made possible all sorts of new capabilities looks like it's either done or at the very least on life support mode.
So scale won't matter for us. It doesn't help us with that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Now, I think there's certainly a lot of effort going into finding ways to resuscitate Moore's Law when it comes to average cost per transistor, but it's going to be hard because it's getting harder and harder to shrink transistors. And so I do worry about Moore's Law via that definition. But I think in terms of scaling, we've got at least a decade ahead of us.
Yeah, but I guess if you get the decade and you don't get less expensive, you don't get less expensive chips in the end, you get products that are more expensive because of also the increased cost to produce a fab.
That's right. Yeah. And that's why the focus now is not solely on scaling, but also on, can you devise new architectures that with the same number of transistors can do more interesting things? So, you know, I look at the shift from CPU to GPU in data centers as a interesting trend in rethinking chip architectures to provide new capabilities that weren't previously available using the same basic manufacturing processes in new ways.
Have you heard of Rock's Law before?
Yes, but I forget what it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's not for me to explain to you these things. I could get it wrong. But basically, Rock being the first investor in either in Intel or Fairchild, I forget.
Yeah.
Said to Gordon and to Carver-Mead, I guess, that while Moore's Law appears could happen, it could be true, the cost to build a fab would increase exponentially every 4 years.
Yes. Yeah.
And it seems like that's happening. I mean, the cost of these fabs is enormous. And so I see this problem that you bring up about not the reduction. You don't get the reduction in the cost of a chip. You get an increase in the expense of a fab as being really worrisome to, do you actually have an iPhone that costs twice as much by next generation?
Well, it is, I think. And, you know, I think we do need some creative ideas as to how do you drive down cost again. And it's no longer just incremental changes. We need big thinking. I mean, one of the striking facets of semiconductor manufacturing is that it's not just Moore's Law. It's not just that we've gotten Moore's Law on the result, the finished chip. We've also basically done Moore's Law throughout all of the manufacturing processes. So the tools themselves are doing the exact same things as tools 50 years ago, just vastly better. So we have lithography tools that in the past were able to print large shapes. Now they print small shapes. We have deposition tools that in the past deposited fairly thin films and materials. Now they deposit nanometer scaled thin films and materials. And so we've had the scaling across the manufacturing process steps without actually as much innovation in the types of processes in the manufacturing that you might actually expect. And so it, in some ways, I think the entire industry has some out of the box thinking to do about let's not only scale down and make more precise the manufacturing processes, but what are some new processes that might be able to provide the same capabilities at lower cost?
So this then, you know, these seem like these large government efforts because it's so expensive to be doing all this thing, you know, these things. We already have, you know, the Chinese government probably supporting its industry. You have Taiwanese government that supported the rise of TSMC, at least. I'm not sure if they still support TSMC, but it was an important sort of state actor, I would guess. And now the United States is getting in the game with the CHIPS Act. Can you explain a little bit your thoughts on the CHIPS Act and what it is and what difference you think it will make?
So the CHIPS Act is a piece of legislation that was funded by the U.S. Congress last year, and it provides around $50 billion in funding to the industry. Around a quarter goes into R&D and three quarters go into incentives for firms that manufacture in the U.S. And the goal is to increase the share of chips that are made in the U.S. On the rationale that it's more expensive to produce chips in the U.S. for a variety of reasons, labor costs, environmental regulation, et cetera. And because it's more expensive, the share of chips produced outside the U.S. has increased dramatically in recent decades. And so there's $39 billion that are allocated to these incentives, and that might sound like a lot of money until you think of the fact that a single facility can cost $20 billion. And this is money that'll be spent over five or so years. So $39 billion becomes $8 billion or so a year if it's spent equally each year over 5 years. And so suddenly it's not a lot of money. And the challenge I think that the government faces is you've got a moderate size amount of money. How do you spend it in a way that actually moves the needle? And that I think is the challenge. There's no doubt that if you spend money, you can get firms to build new facilities in the U.S. But if you've only got $8 billion or so to spend a year, that's not enough to really transform the industry. And so you've got to try to be creative.
And you have potentially 5 years to wait to see how it pays off. You know, if this is a race, it's not a very fast race at this pace, I guess. Do you worry that there's some concern that money is going to go to, you know, very large traditional semiconductor companies, and that, you know, the other room for innovation may be left out, or even room for companies or ideas that are more agile that won't take the 5 years to get there. Do you have that concern at all?
You know, I think this is a real, real dilemma. On the one hand, it's big established firms that manufacture chips and that manufacture the tools that manufacture chips. It's hard to see a small startup getting from zero to scaled in a 5 year time horizon. It's going to take longer. On the other hand, there are certainly a lot of interesting new ideas about how to drive down the cost of chip making, how to drive down the cost of design, for example. But when you look at how the industry is structured, there's just a lot of big market power that big firms have, both in terms of the production and in terms of the purchasing. So, you know, if you're a big cloud computing firm, which are key buyers of chips, you know, they do play around with different customers or different providers of chips, but they're also hesitant to take risks because their business is at stake. So there's a lot of actually risk aversion in an industry that you might think would be defined by willingness to try things out. And so that's why I think that there is really a dilemma that the government faces. On the one hand, it wants to be sure it can get manufacturing capacity soon. On the other hand, you're absolutely right. If you only give money to big firms, you're not going to be likely to get the level of innovation that you're looking for.
Yeah. No, it definitely is a dilemma. I also noticed at around the same time, and this goes back to, I guess, war mentality or Cold War mentality, I'm not sure which one it is, at least, that there were new export controls put into place at around the same time you know, sanctions and export controls with China. I mean, it's clear that there is going to be some economic impact, and there probably has been already on American chip makers and equipment makers that aren't able to sell into the Chinese market now. I wonder how that level equals, if it equals out, if, you know, if there's still a benefit, a financial benefit from the CHIPS Act, or is it all, you know, how are firms thinking about this right now?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's sort of a carrot and a stick. The CHIPS Act is the carrot and the export controls are the stick. And it's certainly the case that the controls are going to impact, have already impacted the companies that make the tools that make chips. The GPU makers, for example, that previously were allowed to sell advanced GPUs to China and now are no longer allowed to sell. And then a whole other set of companies that weren't directly impacted by controls, but that will be impacted by reduced sales to fabs in China that are no longer expanding at the rate that they were. So it does impact the industry in the US and Japan and Europe and in elsewhere in Asia. What's the net effect of the controls plus the CHIPS Act? I think will depend on, you know, which firm you're looking at. But certainly we've seen that the industry is having to think a lot more than it used to about where is it producing, what are its linkages with Chinese providers and customers. And I think a lot of CEOs have had to, they've been playing catch up in a lot of ways because they weren't expecting politics to intrude in this industry in a way that it really hadn't for much of the past several decades.
Yeah, no, it is major. I mean, it's truly major. I mean, do you think that one thing that you really get in the way you structured the book, and certainly I found interesting, is that some of these military applications led general purpose computing, even though, as you said, the consumer and personal computing probably takes up so much larger of the power, I guess, of, but being that it starts, do you still see this as things starting in a more, for more aggressive applications?
Well, it's interesting. On the one hand, you know, you certainly see government playing a big role, funding R&D and many different types of chips. And government has some unique requirements in terms of communications, in terms of sensors, in particular, that have catalyzed, and I think will continue to catalyze, types of technologies that are eventually commercialized. On the other hand, governments are increasingly reliant on chips made primarily for civilian uses as components in the defense system. So if you look, for example, at data centers that are serving the government, they're full of the same chips that data centers are that are serving civilian clients. In many ways, they're the same data centers. And so that's a case where the government and military uses are reliant on consumer demand to provide them with the chips that they need. And if you look at high-performance computing, for example, you know, you really see it's civilian demand that is driving innovation, that is driving the funding of innovation in the sphere. And government is a moderately sized buyer, but it's far from the institution that is really setting the path in this segment.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the one that comes to mind now that's, you know, very defense oriented, and I always, you know, I made an argument to Congress that it shouldn't be, but is quantum computing. Did you come up against quantum computing in your research and how that's being funded for either for civilian or military purposes in China and the U.S.?
Yeah, you know, I didn't do a lot of deep research in quantum computing because it, in some ways, is a adjacent but distinct sphere from the types of chips we've been talking about. But I think there probably are some similarities to the early days of classical computing.
Right.
Whereas, you know, here the question is probably not only which country is the first to invent kind of practical uses of quantum computing, and but also which country is the first to scale it. And scale will require civilian uses. And I think there's probably insufficient focus put on that question, and that will probably be determinative.
Yeah, no, I think so too. What about the more directly security oriented concerns, like cybersecurity concerns, things like what if there is a man in the middle attack put on chips directly, or, you know, maybe spyware put directly on chips? How much is this playing into policy, and how much do you think we should be concerned about this?
Well, I think policymakers are catching up to this risk, to be honest. I think that that everyone now knows about hacking from dozens and dozens of newspaper headlines. They've read about hacking, but hardware security is something that almost no one has read headlines about. The fact that microelectronics can be compromised is something that the typical person is completely unaware of. And that's true for the general public, but it's also, I think, true for many policymakers. Now, there's an interesting question to be asked about: if you had to allocate $100, how would you allocate that between software security and hardware security? And I think the scale of the software security risks that we're aware of suggests that there's probably relatively more vulnerabilities there than in hardware security. But I also think that we're probably underestimating the potential impact of hardware vulnerabilities, in particular because they're harder to identify and much harder to address.
I mean, we see this in factories where people think that they're dealing with cybersecurity by having more air gap facilities and trying to do as much as they can on the edge, trying to stay. But if there's already something put into the chip itself, you're stuck. You know, you have like this kind of Stuxnet style event, but happening in, you know, in potentially in normal companies, not alone just in governments.
And I think that, you know, now we've got a big ecosystem of firms that are capable of identifying cyber intrusions and tracking them and strategizing about them. And this has been a huge growth industry the last decade. For better or for worse, all these tools exist. Whereas with hardware vulnerabilities, the tools are often barely there.
Yeah. Yeah, we've noticed that. It's scary. It's scary stuff, but you know, what gives you the most hope right now? Is there anything in the world that looks rough to me for the reasons that we talked about? You know, it looks like things are going to get more expensive. That's just that can become starts as a small problem, could become a large problem. We have this concentration of power right now in one large semiconductor company. We have a CHIPS Act that doesn't particularly get you a ton of money and runway against potential. What gives you hope right now, if anything?
Well, I think I would say a couple of things. I mean, one, I think Moore's Law continues, even if in its more expensive form. And we're still seeing the benefits of that, year after year. And that's a very good thing, critical, I think. And I do worry that we wake up 1 year and we haven't gotten the progress on doubling that we've expected. And that will be, I think, a traumatic moment. You know, it's one thing to have to pay for it, but it's something to actually not be able to get it. And that's what I worry about. I think if you look at the ways that our advances in computing are enabling more rapid advances in computing, that positive cycle, I think, basically continues. And, I think there's a lot of conversations that have been had about ways that generative AI will drive down the cost of programming, drive down the cost of software. And I think that's true in the software space, but I don't think that's true in the chip design space. We'll have to wait and see.
Unless there's some real novel designs.
Well, yeah, I mean, we'll see. It's hard to predict, I think. Right. But I think that's an interesting question. Will that be true or not? I also think that it'll be easier to customize software to specific hardware as we drive down the cost of software production. And we know that there are a lot of gains to be had from software hardware customization. And in the past, it's just been expensive to do that on both the hardware side and the software side. So that's an interesting question as to the extent to which we'll be able to keep applying new computing capabilities to develop the next generation of computing power.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting whether the excitement around generative AI will actually spark innovation in the hardware space. And it's possible. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at just even the current generation of electronic design automation tools, the tools that are used to design chips, you know, in many ways, they're certainly highly automated. I don't know if you'd call them, intelligent in their own right now, but the whole concept behind these tools has been computer-aided design. they were called CAD tools actually in their earliest iterations in the 1970s. And we're still getting computer aided chip design to this day.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else, Chris, you'd like to talk about that you haven't been able to lately or nobody's talked to you about?
Well, I think the other interesting question is thinking about the environmental implications of semiconductors. Just got back from Taiwan, which is, of course, the world's most important chip maker, but also an island starved of both power and water, mm-hmm. Which are two key inputs in chip making. And one of the laws that died earlier before Moore's Law was the law that said power consumption would also decline exponentially. And that's power consumption does keep declining, but not at the same rate we had hoped. And I think it is worth our considering, do we have the power to keep funding ever more power hungry chips, especially for high performance computing into the future? And if you look at the current exponential growth rates, I do worry about the cost simply of powering the chips that we're producing.
Did you research wide bandgap materials at all?
I did not in extraordinary detail, but yes.
I mean, so there's some hope there. Both on the process side and the performance side, you know, much less water usage. And then on the, you know, sort of, if you would say sort of a net zero effect or whatever, you would have, you know, the chips that have much greater power efficiency for those applications that are needed. So I see some hope there, but certainly to continue to make chips the way we do seems in the United States, we put them in places where there's no water to also. That's always surprises me.
Arizona, yes.
Yes, you notice. Well, why is Arizona the chip hub of the United States? I'm actually curious. Do you know why? Just incentives?
I think it dates back to Motorola had some aircraft manufacturing facilities, if I recall correctly, there in the 1950s, maybe. I think that was the initial catalyst for Arizona's electronics industry.
Interesting. Yeah.
Dependency.
Did the TSMC facility open in Arizona yet?
Not yet, but I believe 2024 is what they're targeting.
2024. Okay. Well, not quite 5 years away then. We get something else built here. Well, thank you, Chris. I really appreciate you coming and doing this. I know you have a lot of these to do. I'll continue to be giving your book away. I think it's wonderful and it sparks so much conversation. And what's next?
Well, to be honest, I'm hoping to spend some time later this year digging into some new project areas. I've been trying to get smarter on biotechnologies, which I think have some comparable trajectories in terms of productivity improvements to semiconductors in their early days. But I don't know if there's going to be a book there or not. I'll have to wait and see.
Well, I really look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.